Well, good morning. Good to see everybody today. Hope you had a good night's rest. Glad we can be together again this morning in this Bible class period. So good to see everybody. Appreciate so much the wonderful way that you've been here on Friday night and Saturday night. We just had wonderful crowds, both of those weekend nights. And as we said each time, I know there are a lot of things that challenge for your attention in the Metroplex on a weekend. And appreciated so much being with us. Great to see you. I was thinking last night, you know, they announced that that Vicky Petty was at the emergency room having her hand sewn up from when she had cut it. And then last night, of course, Beverly had a near-death experience here and had to go to the emergency room. And I just want to compliment you on your bravery for showing up this morning, because clearly I am lethal to this congregation. So, and glad that Beverly's here. She's doing better. You know, they used the paddles on her 3 or 4 times, and it was just, you know, they did a little open heart surgery last night, and here she is, just amazing this morning. Glad that both of them are okay. Glad Beverly's okay. In this Bible class period this morning, I want to talk just a little bit about news good enough to share. I want to talk a little bit about evangelism for the rest of us. I know that when I put that on the screen, and as soon as you see the word evangelism, that it probably makes you uncomfortable. The fact of the matter is that talking about evangelism is the one topic that makes both the speaker and the audience uncomfortable. The audience is always uncomfortable because they are afraid that they're going to be made feel guilty for not doing enough. And the speaker is always a little uncomfortable because we know what the audience is thinking about that. So I'd like to ask you this morning, as best you can, to disabuse your mind of that. And let's start this morning with a fresh slate, because I will tell you that I am not into drive-by guiltings. I just want to talk to us about some things that all of us, it doesn't matter if you're 18 or 80, there are some things that all of us can do along this line that I think are fairly simple. And so we're going to divide this lesson in 2 sections. One half where we're going to talk about a passage of Scripture that deals with this, and the second half, some practical things that we can do along this line. I am a great fan of John Grisham novels. In the past 20 years, he has sold somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 million copies of his books. Can you imagine that? 300 million copies. And I believe that I've read every novel, except for his last one, and I have it, I just haven't started on it yet. And it's interesting that it didn't start out so well with him. His first book was entitled A Time to Kill. It sold 5,000 copies, which in the literary world is just virtually nothing. His second book was entitled The Firm, and it really wasn't doing any better than A Time to Kill. But as people began to read The Firm, they really did like it. And then they began to learn a little about him, and they liked him. And so it went on, as people told others about it, it went on and sold 7 million copies. And then people who read The Firm and liked it went back and bought A Time to Kill, and it became a bestseller as well. And all that happened because individuals who read the book liked the book and the author of the book, and so they told others about that. Doesn't that say something to us? I mean, does that sound a little bit familiar to what we are about when we think about the gospel a little bit? But let's take that a step further. Imagine that you have a son or a daughter who really is a very talented writer, and they really do believe that they'd like to make their living, their life, as an author. And imagine further that John Grisham were to contact you and say, you know what, I've read some of the writings of your child and they really are gifted. And so here's what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to come and spend a week with your family and mentor your child in writing. How valuable would that be? Or imagine that you have a teenage son or daughter that is a very gifted golfer. They're not just a duffer. They are gifted to the point that you believe they may be able to make a living on the tour using this gift. Well, how valuable would it be if someone like Phil Mickelson or Rory McIlroy were to contact you and say, you know what, I saw some film the other day of your son playing golf, and he really is a talent, and so here's what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to come, and for a week, I'm willing to mentor your son in this craft. How valuable would that be? Well, obviously, that would be, it'd just be invaluable to us, wouldn't it? Well, when it comes to evangelism, we get to learn from the very best. Because it's as if God Almighty looked down from heaven and chose an evangelist to send around the world, what we would call a personal worker to impact countless lives. He chose Saul of Tarsus. In fact, he uses that language. He said, "You shall be a chosen vessel for me." And so, if I want to know something about evangelism, I couldn't learn from anyone better than him. And so we could look, for example, at Acts chapter 13, and we could read about those three missionary journeys and their countless stories of success and failure, and there's an awful lot to learn from both. But it seems to me that Paul gives us a synopsis of evangelism in Colossians chapter 4. Do you have a Bible this morning? I want you to open with me there, if you will. Colossians, the fourth division. And we're just going to read two or three verses together and see if you can't immediately see what I mean by that. In Colossians 4, beginning in verse number 2, listen to what he says. Colossians 4, verse 2, beginning. He says, "Continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in prayer along with thanksgiving. And meanwhile," he says, "pray also for us, that God would open to us a door for the word, to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I also am in chains, that I might make the gospel manifest as I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one." Let's stop right there. It seems to me, when I read Colossians 4, 2 through 6, it seems to me that Paul takes the experience from years of missionary journeys and thousands of conversations with individuals about the gospel, and it seems to me he distills the essence from that and says, look, here are three or four things that are absolutely critical. And what I want you to notice, ladies and gentlemen, is that it doesn't have anything to do with methods or systems or marketing or selling or closing the deal. Now, there may be some methods and systems that might be beneficial, but that really isn't what this is about. Primarily, Paul says, it's about one individual introducing someone else to the Son of God. And it seems to me that he says basically three or four things. Let me give you these, and then we'll talk about some practical things that we can do. But from this passage, there are two or three things. Number one, it seems to me that he says, look, consider your God, that this all has to begin with God. Consider your God. Now, here's where he said that. He said, meanwhile, praying also for us, that God would open to us a door for the word to speak the mystery of Christ, to which I'm in chains, that I might make it manifest as I ought to speak. And so he begins by saying, look, I need your help. That's amazing to me. That the Apostle Paul writes and he says, look, I need your help in this. Can you please pray for me? I got to tell you, I find that absolutely amazing. I mean, to me, that would be like LeBron James coming to me and saying, Don, could you show me how to shoot a jump shot? I think he already knows how to do that. I think he's got that figured out. It would be like Dak Prescott coming to me and saying, hey, Don, could you show me how to throw a spiral? I think he knows how to do that. And in fact, he does that extraordinarily well. This is the Apostle Paul. Holy Spirit-filled, brilliant scholar, seasoned veteran, gifted evangelist, church planter. And he says to the Colossians, I need you to help me. And what I need your help with is I need you to pray for me. And specifically, he says, I want you to pray that God will open a door of opportunity for me. And I would just say to you that we need to pray the same prayer. We need to pray to God every day when we get up and say, God, today, just give me an opportunity. Open a door. Pray for that interaction with your neighbor or with the other moms at playgroup or with the teacher down the hallway from where maybe you teach or the guy who works in the cubicle next to you at work or your friend that you have at school or at college. Just pray for an open door of opportunity to say something that introduces the subject of God or faith or Jesus or religion or the Bible or hope. Now, I want you to notice that he doesn't say, I want you to pray that God will open a door so that I can speak to 80,000 people at AT&T Stadium. He doesn't say that because you know why? That's not going to happen. But interaction with somebody at work or at school or just somebody in casual conversation that you meet and have an opportunity to say something, a friend, a coworker, absolutely. And secondly, he says, I want you to pray that I'll have the wisdom to know what to say. So I'm asking you to pray. Amazing to me, isn't it? This is the Apostle Paul, and he says, I need you to pray that I'll have the wisdom to say what needs to be said. Well, I mean, if Paul said, I need that help. Probably we're going to need that help from God as well. We've all been in circumstances, haven't we? We've all been in circumstances where we know that an opportunity is being presented to say something, but we didn't know exactly what to say. We've all had that experience. I mean, if you've got any mileage on the odometer of your life as a Christian, you've been there where you know this is an opportunity. This is on a silver platter. What do I say? And that's where we sometimes struggle with that. I will tell you where to begin with that. I know where we all want to begin. We all want to begin with, here are five reasons why you need to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. But that isn't where what people want to begin. You need to begin with where they are in life. And talk about life. Talk about their life. Talk about your life. Talk about what Christianity has meant to you. Apply that to the opportunity that somebody has given you. Why? Well, because that has credibility with people. People can't argue with that. They can't argue with your experience and what it means to you. We can do that if we'll just think about how to do that. In Temple Terrace, Florida, where I've lived now for 24 years now, when I first moved there, the first week that I was there, I asked one of our members about which dry cleaner they use, and he told me, and so that's the dry, I've used the same dry cleaners now for 24 years. When I first started going there, there was a father in the family that owned it. He was kind of a crusty old guy, but I always got along well with him. He passed away several years ago, and so his son took over the business. And his son is the exact opposite of his dad. He is happy and friendly to everybody, loves everybody, has a great spirit, a great attitude about everything. His name is Mark. So I always enjoyed seeing Mark. I went in one day. This was maybe three years ago. I went in one day, and Mark, something was clearly wrong. His disposition had changed. He was obviously weighted down with something. And I said, Mark, what's going on? I said, because something's different here. And he said, oh, Don, he said, it's my wife. He said, she's been diagnosed with breast cancer. And he said, it's really pretty serious. And I said, Mark, I'm very sorry about that. I said, you know, my wife's never had anything like that. I said, but I will tell you, my mom and dad both had cancer. And I said, Mark, what got me through that with my mom and dad was my faith. I said, what's your wife's name? And he said, well, her name's Valinda. And I said, I tell you what, Mark, I'm going to pray for Valinda. And I'm going to ask some of the other members of the church who come in and use you that you know, I'm going to ask them to pray for Valinda as well. And so as I'd go in periodically, I'd say, well, how's Valinda doing? And I didn't do it all the time, you know, but periodically I'd check. And one day I went in and I said, how's Valinda? He said, oh, Don. He said, man, she's been pronounced clean of her cancer. She had gone through radiation and then she had gone through surgery and then some chemotherapy. And he said, she has been pronounced free of her cancer. I said, oh, Mark, man, we just thank God for that. What a great thing. Well, about a week later on a Sunday morning, I'm standing in the foyer and a lady comes in that I don't recognize. I don't know her. And I go up and introduce myself and her name happens to be Valinda. It's Mark's wife. And one of our families immediately took Valinda under their wing and asked her to come in and sit with them. And they began to study the Bible with her. And it wasn't very long until Valinda was baptized. She's extremely faithful to this day. And it was interesting that when they were studying with Valinda that Mark would be in the other room. Mark is Jewish. His family is Jewish. And Mark would not come in the study, but they could tell he was listening in the other room. And eventually he got to where he was giving Valinda questions to ask while he listened in the other room. And lo and behold, about a year ago, Mark became a Christian. He is as faithful to God as he can be. He's the only person in his family who's ever left Judaism. He's paid a price for that, by the way. But it all began because I just found an opportunity to say, Mark, let me tell you, what helps in those circumstances is your faith. I'll pray for you about that. I'll pray for your family. Just opening a door. That's all it is. Just finding a way to open a door. And Paul said, I'm praying specifically. I'm asking you to pray specifically for God's help in this. And we all need to do that. We need God involved in the process. You know, as Paul said to the Corinthians, who is Paul? Who's Apollos? You know, we are just ministers. That's it. And he said, I planted, and Apollos watered, but God gives the increase. So we need to incorporate God in that process because after all, he knows which hearts are open and available. And he knows which hearts are hard as stone, even though the individual may be the nicest person you've ever met. We need to pray for God's guidance to open doors and open hearts, and pray for God's wisdom in dealing with those individuals, and pray for God's help in the process. And when the individual is obedient to God, we need to make sure that we're giving him the glory for that, the praise for that, the honor for that. Because you and I didn't die for anybody. We are just, we're just ministers through whom others are allowed to believe. And so, number one, we need to consider our God. Secondly, out of Colossians 4, we need to consider our contacts. I wish I had a better word for that. That's an old Church of Christ word, contacts. And I wish I could think of something better than that, but we all know what we mean by that, so we'll just stay with that one this morning. Consider your contacts. And it's interesting the way that Paul phrased that in Colossians 4 and verse 5. He said, I want you to walk in wisdom toward those who are outside redeeming the time. Walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside redeeming the time. Now, outside is interesting, isn't it? Because that's not politically correct. And yet, Paul divided the world into two categories. Those who were in Christ and those who were outside of Christ. Now again, that's not politically correct because we live in an all-inclusive, everybody gets a trophy kind of world. But spiritually, it doesn't work that way. And maybe sometimes that's part of our problem. I think sometimes part of our problem is that neighbor who is so friendly and the coworker who is so helpful and the student who is so brilliant and the family member who is so loved, we sometimes forget that if they've never been obedient to Jesus Christ, they are lost spiritually. They may have all those other wonderful traits about them, but spiritually that would mean that they are lost. So what do we do about that? Well, I think we have to build some relationship. Walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside. The assumption that Paul makes in that, by the way, is that you're going to have some interaction with individuals who are not Christians. You're going to have opportunity, occasion to walk in wisdom toward those who are not Christians. They are on the outside. Paul never assumed that when you and I we became a Christian that we were going to just hibernate in some Christian cocoon somewhere and never interact or rub shoulders with individuals who were not Christians. I think sometimes that we think that would be great. I think sometimes we think, look, if I could just live in a gated Christian community and get up and go to my Christian job, and if I could go buy groceries at a Christian grocery store and my gas from a Christian gas station, and if all I had to do was just rub shoulders with other Christians, that would be the greatest thing in the world. And Paul says, no, not at all. Jesus didn't see it that way. Jesus said, you're the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world. You're here to make a difference among those who don't know God. Paul said to the Philippians, among whom you shine as lights in the world. You find yourself in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. And so Paul just assumes that we intentionally, purposefully, are going to relate to people and make an effort to introduce them to Christ. And then once we do that, we've got to walk through those open doors. You know, when an opportunity is provided, when a door is open, we've got to walk through that. So when opportunity knocks, we've got to answer. Paul once said, I become all things to all men. Don't misunderstand that. He's not saying that he was going to sacrifice his values or his morals or his character, but he's saying, look, I'm going to try to positively interact with and be involved in as many lives as I possibly can. That's exactly what Jesus did. Now, he got in trouble for it. And so his critics were forever saying things like, he eats with tax collectors and sinners. And Jesus would hear that, and he would say, guilty as charged. You know why? Because folks who are well don't need a doctor, but people who are sick. And I'm come to try to help individuals who need to be made right with God. That says something to us, doesn't it? It's intentional relationships with others. And then third, we've got to watch our words. Got to consider our words. Colossians 4 and verse 6. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. You know what that means, ladies and gentlemen? It means that what you say and how you say it matters. What you say and how you say it matters. If you don't believe that, just remember that story in Matthew chapter 26 when Peter is warming his hands at the enemy's fire and the young girl says, you were with the Galilean. And he says, no, you got me confused with someone else. And she says, no, you do because I can tell by the way you talk that you're a Galilean. People can tell something about us by the way that we talk and by the words that we say. Who we belong to, and whether or not we are actually living who we say we are. And so as we consider our words, you know, we need to remember it is amazing grace, how sweet the sound. There is much to be against. There's an awful lot that's wrong in this world. The Bible says a lot about sin and judgment. There's no denying that. We're not going to sand the edges off that or try to mitigate that in any way. But the fact of the matter is, we've also got to let people know that God's grace can forgive them, that God can make them into something better, that it is amazing grace. And Paul says we've got to be able to answer each one. I like the way he phrased that. We've got to be able to answer each one. You know why? Because individuals are just that. They're individuals. We are not clones of each other. We are different from each other. And so even when you take the gospel that doesn't change, when you take the unchanging gospel and you're going to present it to individuals, we have to realize that they are different. You can't just approach everybody in the same way. Some individuals are very analytical in the way that they deal with things. And so they want everything in a logical, sequential order. You've got to walk them from point A to B to C to D. You've got to show them how that is logical and sequential and orderly. But some individuals are not analytical at all. They're very emotional. And so for those individuals, the story of the cross, the story of a sacrifice, is going to impact them greatly. Some individuals are skeptical. And the first thing they're going to want to know is not my five reasons why baptism is essential to salvation. They're going to want to know, first of all, what does Christianity mean to you? You're asking me to alter my life, change my life. Fine. But first, tell me what it's meant to you. How's it changed you? How's it made you a better mom, a better dad, a better worker? Does it make you happy? Does it make you sad? What's it done for you? So before you ask me to change my life, tell me, how's it changed yours in a positive, beneficial way? See, we've got to be able to know how to answer each one. So consider your God, consider the people that you want to deal with, talk to, and consider your words. I want to segue out of that, if I may, because all of that is, we're all on the same page about that. Nobody's going to argue with that. That's simply written in the Bible. But I said a moment ago that I think there's some things, it really doesn't matter, again, whether you're 8 or 18 or 80, there's some things that everybody can do in regard to evangelism, that are non-threatening, that are fairly easy when you think about them, and everybody can do them. We, in the congregation that I'm a part of, we, several years ago, we were getting ready to move into a new facility, and so we invited several gospel preachers from around the country that had had great success in evangelism to come and talk to us a little bit about that, about what they had done and what had worked for them. And we tried to incorporate what we thought might work well for us. And one of the men who came, in one of his lessons, just kind of in a passing way, he said, you know, there are four things that everybody can do in evangelism. And he said, they're easy. Everybody can do it. Doesn't matter what age you are, how much education you have. Doesn't matter if you're a baby Christian or whether you're a seasoned saint. It really doesn't matter. He said, there are four things that everybody can do. And he just kind of ticked them off, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Well, we kind of went back and thought, man, that's pretty good. We want to talk about that a little bit. And so we've kept these things for years now in front of our church family. We put them on bookmarks. We put them on the screen. We try to remind people, look, everybody can do these four things. And so we elaborated on them. And I want to share them with you this morning with just a little bit of elaboration, if I may. And I think this is important. Luke 19 and verse 10, Jesus Christ came into the world to seek and save that which was lost. And so if we're going to wear his name and say that we are Christians, that we are Christ followers, well, surely that ought to matter to us because that's what mattered to him. And I would just suggest that everybody can do these four things. Again, it doesn't matter whether you've been a Christian for 60 days or 60 years, you can do these four things. Here they are. Number one, everybody can shine. Everybody can do that. Everybody can live a Christian life that is worth emulating. A Christian life that has an impact on others. Jesus said that, didn't he? You are let your light rather so shine before men that they may see your good works and thereby glorify your Father which is in heaven. How we live, ladies and gentlemen, matters. And everybody can do that. Everybody can do that. Wherever you find yourself, we can all live in such a way that the gospel is enhanced and never diminished. The Bible talks about that a lot. Remember in Titus chapter 2, Paul writes to aged men and aged women and young men and young women. And in Titus 2, in that teaching, he talks about this. And so he said in Titus 2 and verse 3, make sure that you live in such a way that no one may malign the gospel by looking at your life. In verse 8, he said, make sure that you live in such a way that those who are in opposition to the gospel will have nothing evil to say about you. They'll never be able to look at you and say, you know what? You know why I'm not a Christian? Because I see your life. He said, make sure you don't do that. Or Philippians chapter 1, verse 27. Conduct yourself worthy of your calling in Jesus Christ. Or the passage we read just a moment ago in Colossians chapter 4, beginning in verse 5 and 6. Walk in a worthy way toward those who are on the outside. You know, ladies and gentlemen, the greatest damage, the greatest harm that's done to Christianity is not because of the immorality in Hollywood, California, because of the corruption in Washington, D.C. The greatest damage that's ever done to Christianity is by individuals who come together in buildings like this on Sunday and they sing, oh, how I love Jesus, and then on Monday live in a decidedly different way because people see that. So we need to show by our life that Christianity has made a real, practical, meaningful difference in our life. Everybody can do that. Everybody can live a good, godly, Christian life. Everybody can shine. Secondly, everybody can speak. Now, this is where it gets a little more tricky. Because everybody would say, well, Don, I'm with you. I can live a good life. I can live in such a way that people can't look at my life and accuse me of hypocrisy in regard to my faith. But speak, that's another matter. But hear me out about that. I think that everybody can learn. Once we start thinking about it and we get intentional about it, everybody can learn to season their speech with references about faith, about God, about Jesus, about church, about religion. In Matthew 10, Jesus said, therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him will I also confess before my Father, who is in heaven. He's not talking there, by the way, as you know, you're good Bible students, you know. He's not talking there about the confession before you're baptized. If you want that confession, you go to Romans 10. In this context, where he's just said, if you deny me before men, I'll also deny you before my Father in heaven. Here, he's just talking about everyday life. He's just talking about owning the Lord in everyday life. And we can all do that. Because listen to me now, listen to me carefully. We all naturally talk about things that interest us. And so if we think about it, we can all find ways to incorporate this and find those opportunities and open doors if we just think about it. The problem is I think we often don't think about it. In Temple Terrace, Florida, where I live, there's a Starbucks about 3 minutes from my house. It opened in July of 1999. I remember that because I remember driving by and seeing the sign going up and pulling off to the side of the road and offering a prayer of thanksgiving. And so I've been going there every day I'm home since 1999. They've gone through multiple managers, as those outlets often do. But they had one manager in there who was a very interesting young lady. Her name was Wendy. She was from Chicago, the Windy City. And so I could always remember that. Well, I graduated from high school outside of Chicago. We only lived up there a couple of years. But Wendy and I would talk about Chicago, and we'd talk about life, and she's a very interesting lady. And she liked to work on Sunday morning. She would go in and open on Sunday morning. She liked to do that. There was hardly anybody in there, and she could get a lot of work done. Well, I would go in, you know, very early on my way to the building. My goal on Sunday morning is to be at my building by 7 o'clock. It's just me. It takes me a while to review things and get it in my mind. So I go in there every morning on Sunday. And so one Sunday morning, Wendy's in there, nobody else is in there. I said, Wendy, I come and see you all the time at your job. When are you going to come and see me where I work? And she said, oh, Don, she said, if I ever came into a church building, the building would just collapse. And I said, Wendy, we got a pretty strong building. I think it could handle even you. And she said, I don't think so, Don. I said, okay, all right. So two or three weeks later, I was in. I hadn't said anything again to her, but two or three weeks later, I was in. I said, Wendy, seriously now, I come and see you all the time where you work. I said, I want you to come see me where I work. And she said, well, I'll think about it. Well, two or three weeks later, on a Sunday morning, in between Bible class and worship, I look back and Wendy's standing against the back wall of our building. And so I went up to her and I smiled. I said, Wendy, I said, thank you so much for coming today. I said, I'm really happy you're here. And she said, Don, I know so many of these people. I said, yeah, man, we're all addicted to caffeine here. Well, I got to tell you, Wendy, she had a lot to overcome. She was living with somebody to whom she was not married. She had lived a pretty wild life. But she met some people that loved her and cared about her. And she and I began to sit down and study the Bible together. We opened the Bible and I talked to her about a God that was willing to forgive her of everything in her past, that she could start fresh and new. And it wasn't but about 6 weeks later, I stood in the baptistry with Wendy. And I was crying like a baby when I baptized her into Christ. About a year later, I performed her wedding ceremony. She married a young Christian man. And it began because I just found a way to say, Wendy, how about coming and see me where I work? See, we all can do that. We just have to think about it. You know, we all talk about things that are interesting to us, what we're interested in. We don't have any trouble talking about that at all. We don't have any trouble talking about our kids, about our grandkids. We don't have any trouble talking about our favorite sport team, whether that's college or whether it's pro. We don't have any trouble talking to people about things that matter to us, things that we are really interested in. We can talk to anybody about that. Last year, one morning, I was going to that same Starbucks. A lot of my stories have to do with Starbucks. I'm not addicted. I can quit anytime I want. I just have to have it about 3 or 4 times a day. And so I'm pulling into that Starbucks again, and something clearly is different because there are two Chevy Tahoes that are black, and the windows are completely blacked out, and they're not parked in the parking spaces. They're parked horizontally in front of the Starbucks. And so I parked my car, and as I'm walking in, I notice that there are two individuals outside these vehicles, and they are in suits with dark glasses, and they have earpieces in, and they're standing there by the vehicles. And when I go inside, there's another gentleman inside there, and he's got on a dark suit, and he's got sunglasses on. He has an earpiece, and he's got a little bulge right here on the side. So I know that he's carrying. Now, I got to tell you, coffee's valuable, but it's not that valuable. And so I know there's got to be somebody in here who's important. So I get in line. I don't see the person in front of me. His back is to me, and so I get in line. Well, the gentleman in front of me turns around, and he sticks out his hand, and he says, I'm Rick Scott. What's your name? And I said, well, Governor, I know who you are. I voted for you. And I said, I'm Don Truex. And so we talked for a second. I said, well, Governor, what brings you to Tampa today? I mean, Tampa's a long way from Tallahassee. And he said, I'm here to dedicate a new building over here at USF. And he said, but I tell you, Don, why I'm really happy to be here. He said, I'm really happy to be here because today is my grandson's birthday, and they live here in Tampa. He's going to be 2 years old today. And so I'm going to get to go to his birthday party. And then he said, Don, do you have any grandkids? Yes, I do. Yes, I do, Governor. And so the governor has his phone out, and I've got my phone out, and we are talking about and looking at pictures of grandkids. I got to tell you, he may be a multimillionaire. My grandkids are 1,000 times better looking than his. But here is the governor of the state of Florida, and he and I are talking about family, and we're talking about grandkids and how wonderful that is and how that enhances your life. Why? Because I can talk to anybody about my grandkids. So can you. And we say that the most important thing to us in this world is God Almighty and His Son Jesus Christ and His Word and a relationship with the Son of God. We say the church really does. The church family matters to us supremely. We say that all of this is the most important thing in our life. I tell you, if it is, ladies and gentlemen, we shouldn't have much difficulty talking about it. It should be just natural to try to infuse those kinds of things into our conversation. The problem is we don't think about that. We developed some material years ago in our church, and we have classes periodically. We call it gentle noise, about how to just make gentle noise in conversation with individuals, how to bring up the subject of God or faith or Jesus or the Bible. Everybody can shine, everybody can speak, and everybody can invite. Everybody can do that. That's easy. One of the easiest things you'll ever do in evangelism is just invite. Isn't that easy? And there's good biblical basis for that. I love this story in John chapter 1. Look at this. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, we have found him of whom Moses and the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Nathanael said to him, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And look what Philip said. Well, come and see. He didn't argue with him about that. He didn't say, no. You know, he didn't do any of that. He just said, come and see. Come and see. I've always liked that. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? When I was at Florida College years ago, we named the cafeteria Nazareth because nothing good came out of there. But his response was, look, just come and see. The easiest thing you'll ever do with somebody is say, hey, how about coming to worship with me Sunday? I want you to think about that. The easiest thing you will ever do is invite somebody to come. And you can do that here and know that they'll never be embarrassed. I mean, nobody's ever going to skirt difficult issues or sand the edges off the truth. But by the same token, Terry will present the truth in love. The easiest thing we ever do is invite somebody. Could you come to worship with me on Sunday? I mean, what's the worst that could happen? The worst that could possibly happen is that they might say, thanks, but no thanks. Well, would that be so soul-shattering that we couldn't recover from that? I think we can handle that. Jesus said, go into all the world. I think we use that to assuage our conscience and let ourselves off the hook. And we say, I can't go to the whole world, so really that doesn't apply to me. No. Jesus is saying, look, I want you to go to your world. You go to where you do life. You go to your school, your neighborhood, your workplace, your rec center. You go wherever it is that you do life. And you have some impact there. And one of the easiest impacts that you will ever have in this world is just to say, how about coming and see? Could you come to worship with me? And then, finally, fourth, we've got to welcome those who do. And I think this is important. We don't ever talk about this, but I want to say just a word about it, if I may, in the minutes that we have left. And I want you to hear me out, because we don't ever think about this. We need to welcome those who accept our invitation, who do come and see. Who come into this building and all this is brand spanking new to them. You see, we're very comfortable here, right? We know what's going to come on, or going to happen here. And we know exactly what order it's going to happen in. And in fact, I would just almost guarantee you that if I were to come back in this church in 5 years, I'll guarantee you that all of you are going to be sitting in exactly the same place. I mean, you've got your place, right? I'll guarantee you. We all do that. I sit in the same place every service at home. See, we're comfortable here. In James chapter 2, there is a context of James 2 where James is talking about respect of persons and partiality. And he uses the illustration of people coming to church. And he says, there comes into your assembly a very wealthy man, and he's clearly wealthy by the way that he's dressed. And there's a poor man who comes into your assembly, and you show partiality to the one over the other. He said, that's wrong. Don't do that. But you know what we miss in that story? Now, that's the main application. But what we miss in that story sometimes is the implication that we're going to have visitors in our services. James just assumes that we'll have visitors in our services. We need to think about that. How we treat our guests will have a tremendous impact on whether or not they ever return. I just want to encourage you, when you see somebody come into this building that you don't know, you need to envelop them. Speak to them. Introduce yourself. Welcome them. I said this, by the way, in a church once, and a lady came to me afterwards. As soon as we were finished, she came to me. She said, you know what, Don? I did that once. I saw somebody I didn't know, didn't recognize. I went up to them, and I introduced myself, and they said, I've been a member of this church for 3 years. And I said, that's great. You met somebody you should have met 3 years ago. That's not an excuse. I want you to track with me for just one more minute. Imagine that you go over here to UT Arlington and their drama department is putting on a performance. And so you go. You go and you're sitting in the audience and you're waiting for things to begin. And it's just about time for the curtain to rise and for the performance to begin. And the director comes walking down the aisle, and he comes directly to you. And he comes over to you and he says, could you come with me for just a minute? And so you get up and you're following the director. And he takes you up around and he takes you behind the curtain onto the stage. And you're in the middle of the stage. And you notice that all the props are in place and all the other actors are taking their places on the stage. And the director says to you, one of our performers just called in and they are sick. They're not going to be here tonight. And so we need you to take his place. And he walks off. And there you are. And the curtain rises. And every other person on the stage, they begin reciting their lines. They know their actions. So they're doing everything they know they are supposed to do, and you're standing there, and you have no idea what's going on. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a non-Christian visitor in our worship services. You know the order in which everything will take place this morning. You know the order of everything that's going to be done. You are completely comfortable with that. A non-Christian visitor who accepts that invitation to come and worship with us, they don't know any of that. And so we've got to make sure that we are making them comfortable, inviting them to come sit with us, taking their kids to Bible class, going with them to pick them up, having them sit with us, making sure they know what's going to happen so that they can be as absolutely comfortable as possible among us. You know, we said at the beginning that I'm not much into drive-by guiltings, and I'm not. You're never going to hear me stand in front of an audience and say, look, 6,500 people die every hour. Well, that's true, by the way. That means that 155,000 people die every day, which is true also, by the way. And most of those people die lost, and that's unfortunately true as well. And you know what? It's your fault. I'm never going to say that because it's not your fault. Everybody makes a choice about how they will live their life. But what is my responsibility and yours is to introduce people to Jesus. What they do after we make the introduction is entirely up to them. Have you ever thought about the fact that Paul writes and he says, you know, the gospel, the sound of the gospel has gone to the habitable world. That's an amazing thing to me. How'd they do that? How did the early gospel spread? Have you ever thought about that? The gospel went into the world. Without a single billboard, no correspondence courses, no websites, no Facebook, no text messaging, no Twitter, no television, no CDs, no DVDs, no bulletins, no flyers, and no Bible class material. How in the world did the gospel go to the whole world? It went to the world, ladies and gentlemen, because one hungry person told another hungry person where the bread line was. It happened because one individual who read the book and learned about the author of the book encouraged others to read the book and to get to know the author as well. That's our job. And that all of us can do as we shine and speak and invite and welcome. Thank you for listening so well this morning.